listening to Ding Dong Darkness Time Season 2, Stephen King Boogaloo. I gathered several of my most well-read friends together to discuss many of our favorite works by the master of the macabre himself. If you like what you hear, tell the world. In the meantime, let's talk some scary stories. Oh, and beware the spoilers, folks. They're a doozy. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Ding Dong Darkness Time, our Season 2 Stephen King Boogaloo in full swing. I've had a huge range of guests, but right now I am super excited because my guest today is a bit of a polymath. She's an accomplished author of crime fiction. She carries degrees in both law and engineering. She's an avid collector of rare vintage wares. She's my favorite political wonk. And she quite possibly is the coolest high school teacher on the planet. And most importantly, though, I have the privilege of calling this brilliant woman a dear friend of mine. So, audience, please welcome Terry Lynn Koop to the book club to discuss some of King's collection Night Shift. Hi, Terry.
Hello. How are you?
Oh, so happy.
Me too, and I cannot wait. And as you can see some of what's behind me.
Yes. I was actually admiring that. Terry and I are on a Zoom call, and I could see some really cute vintage stuff behind her. We're fans of so many of the same things, Terry.
Yes, like, definitely.
I love a lot of that same stuff that you do, and was inherited that love for it by my own mom, who collects a lot of the same stuff from the same era, that sort of mid-20th century collectibles and so many amazing things you can find in antique malls and eBay and everything. So,
and Stephen King.
And Stephen King, which is why we are ultimately here. But I wanted to have you on my podcast from the moment of its inception, because really, there's so many areas of your brain that I could like pick for various topics. And so I hope that you'll be back many more times after this.
Anytime.
Yes, yes. Now, Terry, you live down in Florida. You were teaching high school. I would say bravo to you, like bar none. That is a very hard job you are doing right now. But you are making the best of it by giving your students some pretty awesome reading material. So tell me what Stephen King stories you've used in your classes so far and what the general reception has been among the kiddos.
Well, mostly I teach juniors. I have quite a few sophomores this year, but mostly I teach juniors, and mostly I use short stories because all the literary elements that you need to know are in short stories. And for the Stephen King, out of Night Shift, which we're kind of talking about tonight, I primarily use The Ledge, Children of the Corn, and The Last Rung on the Ladder.
Great.
There's a couple of others on the table of contents that would probably get me some phone calls from parents. So
I think Quitter's Ink might be a good one. Maybe it'll, you know, get them off the vape pens or whatever kids are into these days.
Yeah, definitely. And I really wanted to use the boogeyman, because the boogeyman has always stuck with me. Mm. That phrase, just a crack. Just a crack. The door is open, just a crack. And that actually led to a short story I wrote called Coulrophobia, about a clown doll.
Oh, my God.
But yeah, that's another one. I can't scare them. I can't scare the kids too much.
Right. Now, do the kids, are they wowed by these stories, or do you think they're too jaded and desensitized? I mean, do you see any awakenings happening?
For the most part, they're too cool for school. But every once in a while, I'll have somebody come in and go, Miss Coop. And they'll like open up their backpack and there'll be a Stephen King book in there that their folks got for them. Because I'll also use the first act of Little Girl Stuck in the Woods, the girl who loved Tom Gordon.
Yes, yes.
Because that one is about internal conflict and internal dialogue, because she's pretty much alone for the entire first act.
Right.
But The Ledge, I love, because this could actually have been one of Steve's hard case crime books. It's pure noir.
It really is. And it sets itself apart really from the rest of the collection this way. There are 20 stories in this collection, and most of them have been adapted in some way to screen. I would say probably Children of the Corn is the most famous and most adapted from this collection. There are like 12 films that have sprung out of the Children of the Corn. So pretty incredible. But it's so ripe for that, right? But The Ledge, I believe that did not really get much of an adaptation yet. Or there was one in the works. I need to actually look that up really quick. Oh, wait. It was originally going to be part of the Cat's Eye film, along with Quitters, Inc. That's what it was part of. So it was adapted as part of Cat's Eye back in 1985. So
instead, they made a movie out of trucks.
Yeah. Oh, they sure did.
Well, actually, yeah, that's what we
want. Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah.
That's a rough one. That is actually my other co-host, Chris. It's one of his favorite movies. And it's so insane. It's so ridiculous. You could feel the cocaine coming off of that film. And then you could feel the moment in that movie when the cocaine wore off, because then it just really started to drag. So,
an adaptation. I do love the adaptation of Battleground.
I have a star next to that one, actually, is one of my favorite stories in the book.
Yes. And I actually need to visit that one for using in class.
The class would probably really like that one, because there was a similar movie that was made with a similar concept called Small Soldiers. And I think that was back in 2006. About, just as a rundown for folks, like, this one is about a hitman who knocked off the head of a toy company as one of his assignments. And the victim's mom sends him this special lockbox that's filled with toys that his son developed and kind of kept secret. And what they essentially are is sentient miniature army toys, army men, army weapons, the tanks, the helicopters. And they basically start attacking him in full-scale warfare in his apartment. I love that you mentioned the adaptation, because that was adapted, for the show Nightmares and Dreamscapes in 2006 with William Hurt in the lead role, and not a single line of dialogue is spoken in that entire episode.
Well done. And as a short story, it's really well done too, because a lot of what I go with the kids are metaphors, figurative language, that type of thing. And all you have to say is a helicopter the size of a light bulb. it's perfect. I mean, you visualize it immediately.
What's really interesting about it too is when you think about that concept on paper, or like, and just in your head, is like miniature army attacks human. You think to yourself, oh, come on, you could just get a ball bat and just not, like, no, actually, the way that it is staged and the way that it is written, it makes it seem so horrifyingly plausible.
Yes.
That scale is not really the point here. In fact, little things can really bring down big people. I mean, that goes all the way back to David and Goliath. All you need is the slingshot.
But all the way back to like the beginning, Graveyard Shift.
Yes.
Messed me up.
Yes. Oh my God. So yeah, that story I want to touch on for a second. This is the amazing thing about this collection, by the way, is that we're seeing Stephen King at his leanest and meanest. This is his first collection. It was released in 1978, so he was still very new to the publishing world. And so a lot of these stories he had published in the early, mid-70s in a lot of men's magazines, Cosmopolitan, Cavalier, Playboy, what have you. Graveyard Shift is, for me, touches on... The story that precedes it, by the way, Jerusalem's Lot, which is a very Lovecraftian story. I talked a little bit about that on our episode on The Mist when I had Brett from The Prosecutors on, who's a big Lovecraft guy. And so we dissected a lot of Lovecraftian elements of Stephen King's work. We mentioned that one very briefly. There are a lot of rats in the walls, referred to in Jerusalem's Lot. In Graveyard Shift, we're going beyond rats in the walls. We're going full rat kingdom.
I talk about some of the basic categories of horror and class. Supernatural, it's just a hooga booga. It's supernatural.
Right.
Psychological, which is not my actual favorite, because I don't need my nightmares to come true.
Right.
I don't need that. And that's popular right now, but Graveyard Shift falls under environmental, which is just the world is mad at you, and it creates the monsters. Now, a lot of those are metaphors for nuclear war, mm-hmm. but not this one. I don't know. That one just creeps me out.
He brings rats in quite a few. His novella, 1922, from his collection, Full Dark, No Stars, yes. also deals with rats, like scratching rats. It's almost like his version almost of the telltale heart. It seems yes. to be like a metaphor for like guilt and secrets, like things in hiding that are just like scratching away, that sort of, and it really gets under the skin if you're afraid of rats or what a rat might symbolize for you, these sort of hidden creatures that nibble away at things, or like something nibbling away at your sanity, you know?
Well, and he foreshadows it beautifully, even when they pull the hatch off and there's that fungus on the underside oh. of the hatch.
God.
And you just know. This will not end well.
My story Vermin, I had no idea at the time that I wrote my story Vermin back in the mid-2000s that I was probably somewhat telegraphing it, because it's about a pair of exterminators that go into a house that mm-hmm. was once the home of a politician who went mad and killed himself. And there's like, but it's roaches in the basement, and they're venturing down into this house for inspection and to clean it. Mm-hmm. And they of course come across the king of all roaches down there. But I had no idea at the time that I wrote it, but I have a sense that possibly that story, when I read it as a teenager, it just lodged itself. So.
We all write Stephen King at some point, you know, we have no choice. Well, in mine too, like the movie Arachnophobia.
Oh God. Yeah.
And parts of it are just good fun. Mm-hmm. But the part that scared me the most is when he's flipping the teacups that are hanging.
Oh, God.
And there's a spider in one of them. And he's looking up and he's flipping the edges of the teacups. Mm. That, to me, rates as still one of the scariest scenes I've ever been in, because that whole idea of anything that there's millions of is absolutely terrifying.
The hint at the millions, you don't even need to see them, just that you yeah. know, is terrifying enough. It's a bit like, again, I mentioned it, or we talked about it in a previous episode, is this idea that King has this way of making a closed door terrifying. And that's yes. really all that you need, is this idea that of what's behind it. And he really has a way of getting people to use their own internal stores of anxiety to fuel that. Like, he doesn't need to describe it, really.
Well, the one thing that was said about King is Stephen King knows something's under my bed, and he knows it wants to kill me. Well, the closed door, the boogeyman.
Oh, absolutely. That story, everybody that I talk to about this collection, I think that's one of the first stories they bring up. Mm-hmm. I think that's the one that sticks the most with people.
Just a crack.
Oh, God.
Just a crack.
Because anybody who experienced horror, loves horror, or whatever, they all have that childhood fear of the thing in the closet or the thing yes. under the bed. It really is. Even in the, I read through, because I have a very ancient copy of Night Shift mm-hmm. From, God, I think it was probably the first paperback printing. And I was reading Stephen King's little foreword that he does. And, you know, he probably wrote this thing when he was in his, you know, late 20s. But even then, he talks about how he never leaves his foot out from under a blanket, or in the way that fear blinds us and motivates us at the same time. It's a fascinating study. I think King was very well aware of what he was doing at the time, and he was sadistic about it in a lot of ways.
He understands.
He really does. And his own fears play so much into his work. And in many ways, a lot of his fears are universal, too, which makes them work. So,
well, and somebody asked him once, one of the questions he get asked probably by a teacher is, you know, well, what are your themes?
Mm.
And he kind of goes, I don't know. And then he also does a thing, you know, the different ways that children perceive the world from adults.
Yes.
That's one of his themes. And it, in several of his books, is like it, I think in particular, it's, you know, the children are like, okay, there's a monster and we have to kill it. The adults don't see the monster.
Right.
they have different, and I talked about that with my classes, that you get to a certain point where different things scare you.
Definitely.
You know, for adults, man, reality scares us.
Yeah.
We kind of lose the fear of the supernatural and reality scares us. So we don't see the killer clown because we think of all the bills we have to pay.
Exactly. Like we think about what would happen if I lost my job right now and how do I pay my rent? You know that.
So the killer clown just goes right on by us at that
yeah.
point.
Or the killer clown is the mammogram that we got to have next month.
Exactly.
Or, you know.
Whereas the kids are like, killer clown.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're like, you know, quit being so stupid. Yeah. Eat your vegetables. And that he said, you know, he will admit that was one of his big themes that he takes through a lot of his stories is
the way that kids don't have a lot of that baggage to bring into their perception of things. And so, yeah, they see what they see.
Exactly.
And they interpret it in a very raw way, in a very like upfront way, which is, yeah, it's very different. Yeah, I love that. He does that really well in The Body.
Yes.
Or gosh, even his, one of his more recent books that I highly recommend is The Institution, mm-hmm. Which is just probably his best work for me in the last 5 years. He's kind of, you know, been a little inconsistent in terms of the actual like scares and the everything. I feel like as King has gotten older, he's become a little less enamored with the idea of torturing people's senses the same way that he did as a young man. Like, it's like, I've done enough of this. Now I'm going to dig deeper and maybe get into more about like human relationships and things like that, and keeping things a little more grounded in reality, which can be a little scary in its own way too.
Yes. Different things scare us at different ages. But another thing too, is just his driving inevitability.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Children of the Corn. Now, remember, I lived in the Midwest for 20 years, and I tell people, it's like, man, if a kid comes out of a cornfield and you hit it, keep on driving.
Oh,
just
my God.
Keep on driving. Just keep on driving. Don't ever stop.
I would not have stopped. I and out there, thanks to that movie, I remember watching the movie, actually, when I was a kid, the original. I think it had Linda Hamilton in it as the wife. And I can't remember who played the husband offhand, but absolutely terrifying. Mm-hmm. And then it was the first story I read in the collection. Whenever mm-hmm. I got it, I looked at the table of contents and saw, oh my God, Children of Corn? Flip, 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 flip. It's about 3/4 of the way through the book. I flipped through it and dug right into it. And wouldn't you know, it's actually every bit as terrifying. It's a much shorter story, mm-hmm. but it has all the elements are there. And it has that sort of Lord of the Flies-ish, which I know you don't like that. You can even bring that up as a teacher.
Yeah,
I am giving you that, but or Village of the Damned, or one of those where the children take over and they're even more demonic than the adults, because kids, in a lot of ways, they're very self-serving creatures. They're wired to be that way. It takes a while for a child to develop into a kind of an empathetic individual. So when you think about a kid in charge of everything with, I think I brought this up in our Twilight Zone episode. There was the Joe Dante entry to the Twilight Zone movie, which was about this kid, this little boy who had the ability to conjure anything and everything that he wanted in the world at any given time. But he was a very petulant, angry little boy.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
One of the most terrifying concepts on the planet that anybody could devise, an endlessly powerful child. Oh, God help us all. And that's what he does really well with Children of the Corn. We have this village that's been taken over by little kids, and they mm-hmm. are little farm tool wielding Amish kids that worship a creature, he who walks behind the rose.
That one I like too, just for the literary elements of the conflict between the husband and the wife and that sort of thing. It was
I just went on a road trip with my husband across the country as we were driving across Kansas and Oklahoma and, you know, mm-hmm. those parts of the country, they're very rural. Mm-hmm. You can't help but imagine, like, yeah, this could happen.
You're alone when you're out there.
You really really are.
Really are. And that actually became, it was a story that was intended for an anthology, but the anthology folded. I did it with my main novel characters, Jewel and Ethan, and they're on a road trip to go. They're headed to a motorcycle rally. And they're out in the middle of nowhere in their camper, and they run into this demonic, not demonic supernatural, but very evil small town.
Yeah.
That's being run by these thugs. And man, you're by yourself. You gotta take care of stuff. It's called Hunted. And you have to take care of things when you're out there alone.
Okay. Is this story out there or is
That's on Amazon. It's called Hunted. And again, it was part of it. It was going to be part of an anthology that didn't make it. So I went ahead and published the short story.
Oh my gosh. By the way, your work has appeared in a lot of anthologies, right? I mean, you've been in quite a few. So I love seeing that, by the way. The community of writers kind of coming together, and
I have to get back to it. The teaching thing has just been overwhelming.
You know, I've been talking a lot with a couple friends about how it does seem like we have to cut things to make time for other things. Like, what am I giving up in order to make time for this thing that I'm doing right now? Because it seems like the days are just growing shorter the older we get too. And then it's like, I need to sleep. This is what I need. If I don't get this much sleep, I can't do anything. So
yeah, I totally understand that.
I need more hours in this day. I demand
Exactly. Exactly.
So unfair. Oh my God.
One of the questions, what I do when I give it a short story is I usually just do a set of questions, which part of them are, did you actually read the story? You know, I call those what color are the guy's hat story, you know, because you have to find the answer in it. And that just shows me that you read it. And then from there on, they get a little bit more, you have to make inferences out of the story.
Right.
And one of the questions that was kind of funny in the ledge is I just asked the kids, I go, which way is he facing?
Okay. So let's talk about that. I just reread that story last week. It was part of my homework and I zipped through it. Absolutely loved it, by the way. It is a quick rundown for folks who haven't read it. It is a noir crime story. So a man has fallen in love with a gangster's wife, essentially, and they're going to run away together. Well, gangster man is not happy. And he decides to give the man a wager. That's what he calls it. Not a bet, because that's
a wager.
Too cheap. It is a wager. And the wager being that, and he does this to everybody that he's given a wager, is that you have to walk on this 5-inch ledge around the perimeter of the building where his penthouse is. And if you make it back, you can have not only my wife, but 20 grand. And also I'll take the heroin that I've planted in your car to frame you with.
Yes.
And so, you know, the guy really doesn't feel like he has any choice. And so he, of course, does it, all knowing that six previous people before him have failed this challenge. So, yeah, he steps out onto the ledge and he starts making his way around the building and encounters a number of obstacles along the way. And I didn't even think to pay attention to the direction. I just assumed he was facing out because you're just kind of sidling along with your back to the building. Am I wrong?
And how are you going to get around the corner? If your back is to the building.
Oh, God. That was the part that I was concerned about because you wouldn't. You would actually be pitched outward, forward, in order to get around the corner and you would fall. I don't think you could get one foot around the corner of the building and maintain your footing.
But the key is King never says it.
No.
You have to infer it. And I asked the kids, and it was just funny. The pattern in the carpet in my classroom has these squares in it. Mm-hmm. And one of the stripes is about 5 inches wide. So I'm up in front of the class and it's like, okay, I'm on the ledge. Am I facing the building or am I away from the building? Oh. And a few of them, they start raising their hands and stuff. And I'm like, okay, let's examine that. One of the things King talks about is how it's going to take all of his ankle muscles.
Yes.
Because his heels are out over the ledge.
Oh my God. See, that's brilliant.
And then there's part about his hands. It's hard to explain, but he says he puts his palms on the building over his head.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So I had some of the, with some of the kids that had said, well, his back is to the building. And I'm like, what? You think he's got his hands like.
Right. If it's over his head, there's no way. Like that's.
Yeah. And that was just one of those. Again, you draw the inferences that, because sometimes King will take descriptions to the max.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it will be, you'll be like, okay, Steve, I get it, you know. But in these, like you said, very lean, mean, short stories, mm-hmm. you have to infer it.
Also, he has that character peering into the windows as he's going around, which is not easy to do when your back is to it. So now it's coming very clear to me. I actually now want to go reread that story with that in mind. It's such a quick read. It's probably only about 10 pages or so. It manages to pack so much character and so many interesting thrills. And my favorite part by the end of this story, what I absolutely love is, of course, he makes it to the other side, has his confrontation with the gangster who then admits that he killed his wife even before this whole thing started. So, oh, you don't get the girl.
You can have my wife. You can pick her up at the morgue.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, that's one of those too, man. You know, read small print when you're making, you know,
deals
making
with the devil.
Contracts. Yes.
And I mean, really too, what I absolutely love, because the whole idea was like, I never welsh on a wager or a bet. And that was Kressner, the gangster, his whole thing, right?
So,
but then of course our main character gets the drop on him and says, I won't blow your brains out if you make the trip around the building. So hop to it there, buddy.
Pure noir crime.
Yeah. And you don't know, it's very ambiguous by the end. But what I absolutely love, because we don't know if he falls, we can assume that he does, because there's an evil pigeon out there. Let's just say that pigeon is still hungry. So he's going to get his ankles pecked and he'll probably won't make it. But if he does make it, I love how the main character was like, Kressner never welched on a bet, but I've been known to. So
exactly.
Even if he comes back in, he's a dead man.
So yeah, this is, you know, some people were surprised when Steve was published by Hardcase. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, Steve's been writing noir for a long, long time.
He wrote this story as a very young man. And like you said, The Last Rung on the Ladder, that's another instance of this kind of story. And he has quite a few similar ones in his other collections too, these sort of noir crime type things. Sometimes they have a little bit of supernatural-ish kind of things thrown in, or very light stuff, like Strawberry Spring is another story in here. It's a play on the Spring-Heeled Jack lore, but it's all about like a serial killer that's been stalking this college campus. But the narrator's starting to make inferences of himself.
Well, if it's not the last line, it's very close to it, where he says, you know, my wife is crying because she thinks I've been with another woman. And oh my God, so do I.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't want to look in the trunk of his car.
Yeah. Why does the word trunk disturb me so much?
Oh, dear God.
But Last Rung of the Ladder, again, no supernatural whatsoever.
Right.
And the theme on that one, because again, high school English, we have to be really big on themes.
Yeah.
You know, is paying attention. You don't have time. You don't assume you have time. Pay attention, and especially to your family. And when he gets that, you know, that letter that says, I wish you hadn't saved me before the last rung on the ladder broke.
Oh, my God.
Yes. After his sister commits suicide. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mess with the kids' heads on that one, too.
You should. Why do you feel that themes are such an important discussion in these stories for teaching purposes?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of times they're still just too young. They don't really get it. And even on these, a lot of times I'll be sitting there and going, oh, okay, that's what that one is actually about. Although I have some classes that are fairly low readers. And I had one class go, could we maybe read some Percy Jackson?
Oh,
and I'm like, baby, if you'll read it, you can read anything you want to.
Yeah.
And we got talking into about things like, you know, family. Families are hard. Families are messy. Families are complicated. And I kept going after the kids about, why do you think Percy Jackson rejected finding out that his brother was a Cyclops? And I'm kind of like, what's different about his brother? And one of my kids finally goes, he's a different race.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
So it really is a way to help kids kind of understand the wider world, essentially.
Yeah.
Like, what can I derive from this? I find it interesting. I guess I still tend to look at stories that way. As I read them now, like, what can I relate to in this? Or what of my own experience can I apply? Which I guess is a little different than from a kid, because maybe a kid hasn't had a lot of experiences yet. So that evolves as you get older. It's like, I've talked on previous episodes about, like, when you read The Shining, for instance, as a kid, it's a story about Danny. You are following Danny, relating to Danny. His dad is a big mean guy, and he's going through hell in this alone in this hotel with this ability. And it's all very Danny centric. But when you read that story as an adult who's been through some things, it's Jack, like his failures and his, you know, everything that he's been through, his addiction, and, you know, all these demons that are following him, and he's trying so hard to hold it together. And so you just think in your own, through your own lens as an adult who's been trying to hold things together, that, you know, so it's a completely different story.
Well, and we'll get it. And to digress off of Steve again, just for one second, like last week, I was talking about Cinderella. I said the Cinderella myth has been around for about 2000 years.
Right.
And I go, you know, and they're like, huh? And I go, yeah, the Cinderella myth. And I go, the abused, neglected stepchild whose parents like the other siblings better. And you could see them starting, you could see people starting to shift uncomfortably in their seats, because that's it. That's what it boils down to. The neglected stepchild.
It's a timeless theme because, yeah, it's even to this day. I mean, how many of those kids
exactly
are in, you know, mixed families, divorced homes, things like that? Absolutely. And that's why that continues to endure. And also, yes, No Way is kind of similar too, I guess. Anytime Disney just loves to exploit that theme quite a bit for kids, like, your parents are dead and or evil. Sorry, kid, you're alone in this world. the universe does not care.
Somebody's mom is going to die. But no, so now back to somebody who's not quite as evil as Disney, Stephen King. Another thing that gets me about Uncle Steve is he will come up with imagery that gets me in the back of my throat to this day. If I want to actually make myself a little bit nauseous, I think about the blueberry pie incident.
Oh, God.
In the Ballad of Lard-Ass Hogan.
Yes. Yes.
In the body.
In the body. My eldest son, he is horrified. He's very phobic about vomit. And he will even consult the website, Does the Dog Die, which lists in movies all those kind of triggery things that you can decide whether or not to avoid it. He always looks for vomit in every new movie and show that he watches.
All I have to do is even start thinking about that, and I will start tasting it in the back of my throat after a couple of minutes.
Oh,
and
my God.
I'm like, way to go, Steve. I mean, you did it. Which leads into the story on this table of contents, gray matter.
Oh my God. This story, when I was rereading it just recently, it immediately brought back the old original revulsion that I felt when I first read it. I love gross out.
No.
I think, I know, right? That's not me at all. And I love body horror because your body is the thing that, it's your vessel, right? So when it starts to go rogue on you in a very weird and horrifying and disgusting way, it's terrifying because this is the only skin suit you got. You can't change into another one. So to me, that's the most claustrophobic form of horror. So this one, it's the townspeople talking about this guy. So you don't really get into his point of view, but it's enough. I kind of like that he adds that extra layer, because it's already revolting enough. He drank a bad beer that had like some kind of mutagen in it.
Well, and he'll even say, you ever get that, that skunky beer and that thick feeling down your throat, you know, and
So
you get that, you're eating something and you get that unexpected lump where you didn't expect it, you know, and it goes down your throat.
It goes down, and then he starts turning basically into a sentient mold spore.
Monster. Yeah.
Yeah. And the way that he describes how he looks, because it sort of reminds me, he used this device in Pet Sematary when Judd is telling the story of how somebody else in the town buried their son who was killed in combat, buried him up in the burial ground. And he came back and they talk about how they went to the guy's house to confront him about his son who is shambling around town like a zombie and what to do about it. And honestly, it's one of the scariest parts of the entire book, which is already just nothing but one cosmic horror after another. And so that device of viewing it through the eyes of other people who are kind of slightly removed, it makes us feel like we're in that group and viewing it too. It's a very powerful device that I don't know gets explored enough or used enough, but you would think that it would depersonalize it more, but it makes it scarier somehow.
And it goes into that inevitability that Steve does so well, that mm-hmm. inevitability of that, you know, the bad thing is going to happen.
Oh God.
And there's no escaping it.
Yeah. And they tried to kill him, and then, and that's the thing. He starts dividing like a cell, essentially. So to indicate that this is going to spread.
Oh yeah. Cause he starts, 2, 4, mm-hmm. 8. And then I think he gets up to like 16, and then he goes the end of humanity.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Just one skunky beer.
One skunky beer. And then Steve's, his incredible grasp of dialogue, where the guy goes down to talk to Mold Man, and he's like, talks about the kid, the wife's up there making him a toasted cheese. He's as skinny as a slack cat.
And I tell you what, King can sometimes take some hits for some of his dialogue choices. But they are a product of him and his, his upbringing and his age and all that. And to me, it's always just a welcome thing. Like, his dialogue always just feels like at home to me. It reminds me in a lot of ways of like listening to my dad talk. My dad uses a lot of those kind of turns of speech. And so one thing I think about Gray Matter as well is it feels to me a bit like another possible exploration of King's alcoholism and mm-hmm. addiction. Because to me, it feels like a story of like, what eventually happens when you drink,
yes.
You kind of lose that humanity. You become this sludge creature.
Yes, I agree on that one completely. And then his other noir masterpiece in here, Quitters Incorporated.
Oh my God. Now, I honestly do feel like this is one. It is timeless, and it is probably the most relatable for anyone who has ever had to deal with any kind of habit breaking, because whether you've smoked or you drank or you just have some other habit that you cannot kick, imagine that you sign up for a program that has a 98% success rate to get you to stop this bad habit. But the way that they enforce that is that anytime you digress, members of your family get tortured, shocked, electroshocked. And then it becomes with an even bigger twist is that, he goes through the motions of this and does backslide on his smoking. His wife and his kid get kidnapped by this organization and they get zapped. Here's the scary part. His wife was like, oh, honey, but they made you into a new man. You've quit. You've been freed from your addiction. She's almost like cool with it.
Yeah.
What?
Well, and then they're friends and he's like shaking her hand felt strange. And then he realized she was missing her little finger.
Yes. And that was the other thing is that so after he quit smoking, he does what a lot of us that have quit smoking do. He puts on a little weight. I'm a former smoker. Whenever I finally quit my habit about 10 years ago, I put on about 30 pounds. Like that was like practically overnight because you just end up filling one addiction with like another, And so that's what happens to him. And then they say, here are these diet pills. If you put on any more weight, we're going to cut off your wife's pinky finger. Mm-hmm. So now he's roped into becoming, a diet fiend as well. So now he has to watch this. And it's such a metaphor, right? As adults, especially, we are like, okay, I got to cut this. And then, oh my God, I got to cut this bad thing. I got to get rid of all my bad things, all my vices. And it really starts to make you like wonder, like, what are we doing to ourselves as a species and building these industries that essentially torture us?
Yes. And then he says, and then for that recalcitrant 2%.
Yes.
And he pulls out the pistol and he says, but we guarantee you never smoke again.
Yep. If you can't get it, if you have like, is it 10 infractions? We just blow your brains out. You're just done, buddy.
But we guarantee you never smoke again.
And then you're left with this question of, would you do this? Are you desperate enough to quit something to sign up for something like that?
Yeah. It's based on two of like, actually, how much do you love your family?
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah, there's always that one too.
Well, because I mean, when you look at a lot of sort of recovery programs for addictions, it does tie into, yeah, remember the people around you and
oh, yeah,
do this for them. And it really is based on, a lot of that is based on that, but it's such a slippery slope, because what it ultimately does is whenever you have a very normal human tendency to backslide, it compounds the guilt that you have not hurt yourself, you have hurt your family. And then unfortunately, what that shame tends to do is put you into a spiral, and it makes it even worse, and you can't get out of it. It's like, well, I've already let my family down. It can't get much worse from here. Let's just keep on.
Yes.
And a lot of people fall into that pattern too. And there's such an understanding of that truth in this story. Please make your kids read this one. I think it would really gives them some food for thought, you know?
And now, well, but then again, the immature level is like, I'd smoke on purpose.
Right, right.
Because I remember people saying that when this first came out.
Oh my gosh.
It was like, wow, that'd be fun, man. You know? So yeah,
Well, then you get to reveal, like, I guess, like, oh wow, a lot of you are kind of sociopathic.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, the man who loved flowers.
Okay. Yeah. Tell me what you think about that one. Because that is another one that has been vague for me.
You know, this man, they're all, and again, that's another one. He is viewed through the onlooker's eyes. He's, oh, look at that young man. He's in love. He's buying flowers for his beloved. And then he gives the flowers to a woman.
Yes.
It's not her. It's not whoever it is that he's fixated on. And he kills her with a claw hammer.
That's right.
But throughout most of the story, it's all these, you know, little old ladies and everybody. Oh, I remember, you know, remember when you were in love like that, you know?
Oh, my God.
Then it turns into an episode of Criminal Minds at the end. So yeah, that actually would have made a really good episode of Criminal Minds.
I think this is a great segue to talk about this a little bit, because what I absolutely love about King's work in the short story realm is that he started this program called the Dollar Baby Program. And that allowed film students and theater students opportunities to buy the right to adapt one of his short stories for a non-commercial work for a dollar. And it gave rise to dozens of short films and theatrical productions based on these. Almost every one of these stories in Night Shift was made into a dollar baby. Mm-hmm. And probably the most famous person to come out of that program as a director is Frank Darabont, who originally made A Dollar Baby of The Woman in the Room, which in this book is the last story in this book. And it is, it's heartbreaking. I mean, it's about dealing with a terminally ill person and putting them, you know, euthanasia, essentially. Mm-hmm. And he adapted that. And of course, King thought that was like the best dollar baby of all of them. And then, of course, Darabont goes on to make Shawshank Redemption, The Mist, and The Green Mile. And I just found that fascinating. And I think it's such a cool way for King to sort of take his success and use it to help lift up younger creators.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he's smart enough too, that no, you keep bringing up the young,
yes,
readers and creators by doing this. Bradbury was another one like that. You know, it's like, I teach a lot of Ray Bradbury too. Oh,
so glad. I'm one of the absolute best.
And, you know, having a kid come up to me after reading embroidery and going, and then the trees are on fire and then she's on fire and everything's on fire. This messed me up.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
yes. You're welcome.
Yes. Thank you. That you just made my day on that one. And then me realizing that embroidery is actually a metaphor for the Greek myth of the three fates, the three women sewing and all of that and cutting and
Oh my God.
Yes. Every once in a while I'll do that too and I'll be like, well, shit. Damn, I didn't know that until that just came to me just right now, you know, that what this is a metaphor for. But otherwise, they're not going to read Ray Bradbury.
Right.
Unless you start. I use a lot of Bradbury.
You know, another one that might be an interesting choice is Richard Matheson's
stuff.
So prolific and so much short work, too.
The old war horse of Richard Matheson's is Button Butt. But here, and again, before we get back to Steve, is I think Button Button is taught too young for a lot of, you know, they're reading it in sixth and seventh grade.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they go, well, what's the theme of Button Button? Don't be greedy. Well. No, babies. That's not the theme. The theme is about how, you know, if you're not content in your own heart, no amount of money is ever going to make you happy.
Right.
And then we also get in and with my older kids, we talk about what did this do to their marriage?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and even if she hadn't, you know, like killed him at the end of the story, could their marriage have survived it? And they did in the second coming of Twilight Zone, which was kind of cheesy, but they did an adaptation of it that is ungodly cheesy, but he doesn't die. But you get this scene where he's just like, you know, I can't even look at you.
Was this the CBS?
Yeah. In the 80s.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And again, it's unbearably cheesy, but it, you know, but he has this, the husband has this, you know, I can't even look at you moment. So I talk about that with my students who are old enough. It's like, you know, would their marriage have survived this?
And that's something you could definitely ask high school kids who are already probably in a relationship or have been in some relationships or have watched their own, seen a little more of their parents' relationships.
Whereas with seventh grader, don't be greedy, you know, and it's like, okay.
That's precious.
Yeah, that's precious. Another one I use a lot of too, I've become this Henry Slessor groupie.
Oh.
He wrote, a lot of his were adapted for Twilight Zone.
You're absolutely right. I remember seeing that in my homework on Twilight Zone recently.
He's simply amazing. And I've hunted down, relentlessly hunted down his stories. And there's one called Examination Day. Mm-hmm. Which is when you're 14 years old, I think it's 14, 13 or 14, you are tested by the government. And I think I love this one because of all the standardized tests.
Yeah.
You're tested by the government. And if you're too smart, you're weeded out of the gene pool.
You know, that feels too real right now. In so many ways.
You know, I hit this up with the kids because they're all like, I wouldn't take my kids in there to be tested. And I go, well, think about it though. The parents are the ones who passed the test.
Right. Exactly.
Meaning
they're not going to be thinking about it that way.
You basically failed the intelligence test. And you have been ruled to be compliant with society.
This is an episode, you said, of the
No, Twilight this Zone? One this one was not an episode, but okay. It's a short story.
Okay.
It's a short story. I can send you Miss Coop's anthology.
Please do. I would love to read that. I love that whole trope of the test. I did a similar thing in my not great book, The Last Supper. I don't promote that book much, but I played with that concept of when you reach a specific age, and it's more for population control. But if you aren't pure enough or pious enough, then, you know, get out.
Speaking of population control, I'll send you The Carnival.
Oh, okay.
Which is of course, we all love Shirley Jackson.
Oh, yes. But you've had the lottery thrown at you a
lot, haven't you? And two, all you have to do is to, especially to a junior, is say the words the lottery and their eyes just click back in their head.
Oh, God.
Because it gets beat to death.
Right. And that's the unfortunate thing, right?
And honestly, I think if you went to Shirley Jackson and you said, what is the theme of the lottery? She'd go, I thought it was a good story, right. You know? Yeah. And so there's an alternative called the carnival, which is also that kind of population control type thing. That's you win tickets to the carnival and you have a one in eight chance of surviving.
That brings to mind when you talked about just a second ago about what would Shirley Jackson have said about her own themes. And it's funny, as my own writing, I don't often start thinking about theme until way late into the process, because normally I'm trying to just lay the plot down, get the characters, you know, good. And then sometimes it'll come to me as I'm going through a second draft. Those things start to emerge. Those little subconscious seeds that I laid down start to germinate a little more. And then I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I'm going to like move some dirt away from that, give it a little more room to breathe. And so a lot of times it ends up being accidental, the whole theme. So it's interesting when people talk about themes and authors, there's that meme that goes around that said the curtains were fucking blue.
Yes.
And which often means, yes, that was just a choice we made.
Speaking of the fucking blue curtains, in an interview, Stephen King was talking about theme and symbolism.
Yeah.
And he said that one of his early beta readers came back to him with this like, oh, the choice you made, the making her dress green, you know, and it's like, oh my, and you know, he's hitting him up for, you know, why did you choose that symbolism? And Stephen was like, I like green.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's the one that, you know, nice lady English teachers tend to whip symbolism to death sometimes.
Honestly, I think one of the ways to suck a lot of the joy and mystery, and a lot of the joy comes from the mystery of storytelling. Yes. And the fact that you can often tell when a story is trying to present a theme hardcore at someone, because it feels like an overbearing morality play. And I love more when it is accidental. And I've had people, yeah, come at me with something they've read of mine and have been like, oh yeah, this was an interesting theme of such and such. And I'm like, and it's kind of an astute observation. I'm like, wow. Yeah, I guess I did do that. I didn't mean to, but I'm glad you got that out of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was like me coming to the conclusion that, oh shit, Ray Bradbury just wrote a story about the Greek myth of the three fates juxtaposed against nuclear war.
And King loves, in several of his stories, there's a lot of Vietnam backdrop too. I think so. It often does become a product of the era in which you're writing. That's the zeitgeist at the time. It sometimes does find its way in there.
I read an essay where somebody was talking about The Long Walk.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And he goes, you know, this is a metaphor for the Vietnam draft, don't you? And I'm like, well, shit. That just messed me up.
It messes you up sometimes.
And you start thinking about it and it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
You start seeing your buddies fall and you just have to keep walking, and you do it for your friends and then you do it for yourself. And then, yeah,
it is a harrowing one. And now you've done that book for your students. Yeah.
I've used the first act.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if I don't get the canned curriculum put on me, I will use it at some point, because again, you know, I'm telling these kids, it's like, yeah, you know, 100 of them start walking and 99 take it in the head.
Yeah.
And then we start talking about too, that's like, now you have to look at it in the era in which King was there. You know, they're mostly white boys. I go, why not? Why does it have to be? Why can't it be girls? Why can't it be, you know, what would the long walk look like now?
Right. Right. Which is a great way to get someone to really think about the world that we're currently living in.
Definitely.
And bring in a lot of those cultural elements of our own, which is a sign of a really, again, a kind of a beautiful story and a well-made story that you can apply those questions.
Although every once in a while, a Steve book or a Steve story sounds a lot different when I'm retaking it from my memory and then I'm putting it out in front of a bunch of teenagers. And I'm like, okay, we will skip this one.
Yeah, exactly. I would have to say there are a couple in here in particular. Like there are two stories in this book that I think are ridiculous and silly, and for some reason have gotten more attention. Oh, please tell me your pick here.
Lawnmower Man.
Yes. Number one. What the hell, Steve? It's all I could get. And the first time I read it, I had already seen the movie with Jeff Fahey that came out that had his name, and the king went through lawsuits to get his name removed from this whole thing because it wasn't at all based on his short story.
Right.
But the movie is ridiculous as it was. The short story is like a product of a bad acid trip. Talk about a guy who has a lawn service where he eats the grass and then sends the lawnmower after people to kill them if they don't like the fact that he crawls on all fours and eats grass off the ground. I mean, what is this, Terry? What are the themes here?
I have actually assiduously avoided rereading that after like my first read. So, okay. Lawnmower Man. What's the other one?
The Mangler.
I love The Mangler.
The Mangler is great, but it is like probably the pulpiest of the horror.
Well, the one I like about The Mangler is the whole concept of accidentally summoning a demon.
I love that so much, right? Yeah, because of all the accidents that this machine has caused, that it somehow got all the ingredients to summon a demon.
Yeah, and I think I've no doubt written that into a short story somewhere, concept of accidentally summoning a demon. And then it's like, what the living fuck do you do now?
Oh, and then what's funny, and this is what challenges the visual imagination, is so the machine becomes very sentient at the end and it pulls free of its moorings and escapes. So just imagining this giant laundry folding machine loose on the town looking for things to eat, and it's possessed by a demon.
But you know where Steve got that story is he used to run one of those.
He did.
And you know damn well he saw some amazing accidents.
Oh,
because
I can't
even imagine. they had zero safety on them.
Right.
And my late husband used to work at a lithography plant where they were feeding the big sheets of paper in to make posters and stuff. Well, the first thing they did was disengage all the safeties.
Oh, wow.
Because that slowed them down. I was environmental safety supervisor at a factory that made, we supplied the nation with styrofoam meat trays.
Oh, hey.
Yeah. Well, they are high speed pressure, stamping machine. One of the few firing offenses was as if you didn't do the proper lockout procedure, if you had to work on the machine. I mean, it had to be completely killed so that it could not cycle, because you had to reach your hand in between those stamp plates to fix it, to oil it, to do all the maintenance on it. And that was a firing offense. You were ejected from the plant if you ever had a lockout violation. So I
think about a lot too. I work at Trader Joe's. I mentioned that here. I've worked in a lot of grocery stores in my tenure as a grocery type worker. And the cardboard baler is my nightmare machine.
Yes, I have run one of those. Yes,
they are. And the ones at this one chain, this grocery chain we have it here called Meijer, they, because a lot of them are standalone balers that have the hydraulic press coming down from on top. You got to wire the bale up and pull it out yourself, and it's a whole thing, right? Well, the Meijer ones are massive. They're about 20 feet long. Mm-hmm. And then what they do is after they do all the crushing and it assembles the bale, it automatically pushes the bale out along a conveyor belt, but you throw everything in to this giant chute and it just chews it up. It is the most monstrous machine I've ever seen. And all I can imagine is somebody falling into that thing if they're up on a ladder.
And I think that's one of the reasons why I appreciate the Mangler, is because I know Steve came up with that idea. And then again, he just has these beautiful lines like, a demon summoned by the hand of glory could eat a stack of Bibles for breakfast.
My God. I'm so glad you pulled that line. That's a great line.
Because I've actually thought about using Mangler. It's just a little bit long for what I have to play to short attention span theater.
What's interesting, it wasn't made into a terrible film directed by Toby Hooper, which, God rest his soul, I love Toby Hooper, but it starred Robert Englund in the lead role, but it also had two sequels.
No worse movies have been made than out of Stephen King books and stories.
How do you get enough material? I mean, I guess that machine just cannot be stopped. It can be applied. I guess Christine is sort of like another one of those, like, this demonic machine. Of course, there's no real explanation for that, but that's another one of...
One of the problems with Christine as a movie, or actually I was thinking of Cujo and Christine, mm-hmm. is you lose the internal dialogue and it just becomes a, you know, action horror, you know, type flick.
Which is not, yeah, it's not as good without that.
Yeah, like the scene where, you know, Cujo is going after them in the car.
Mm-hmm.
You've
mm-hmm.
got the dog's internal dialogue too. And that's what makes it so terrifying.
Right.
It makes Cujo into this machine that can't stop, you know.
That's an criminally underrated book of King's. What makes it even more amazing reading it is knowing that King was so blitzed out of his mind when he wrote it that he has no memory of writing
it. Yeah. He says, it's real. I really like it too. And I have no memory of writing it. Yeah. So others.
What is your other? Okay, because I said two, and that was mine. Do you have another one that's like, what the hell is this?
Trucks.
Yeah, oh, of course. Okay. Yes. Yes. But I will say in its favor that the short story is better than the movie ever hoped to be, right?
But I mean, it's like, come on, it's like, just make it, just do Transformers, you know? I mean, it's just like, it's like, truck, come on.
The Decepticons have arrived.
Exactly. Let's see, I think it's, which one is it? I think it's I Know What You Need.
Oh,
is
yes.
Is that the one with the eyes and the hand?
That one is... Is that
I am the doorway. Ooh,
that's another great body horror in a lot of ways. I mean, he very sci-fi. He's on his way to Venus and he gets
that one just squicks me out. That one just squicks me out.
I mean, imagine eyeballs on your fingers, Terry. What in the world?
No. And then your chat. No.
And then you're like, you've become a portal to like an alien that's making you do horrible shit.
Yeah.
And then he realizes by the end of it, like, I gotta kill myself. It's awful, but put only in the way that King.
And then, I mean, I love Night Surf, you know, kind of the prequel to
The Stand.
The Stand.
Yeah.
And I've tried to get several kids to read The Stand. I've just said, you need to read The Stand. And I think I've got one convinced that he needs to read The Stand.
First time I tried to read that book, I was in sixth grade. And I got through the first chapter. I used to read the first chapter over and over again as like almost like a short story. It took me probably 10 years or so before I finally was patient enough to sit and read the mm-hmm. entire thing. And I did the same thing with It. When I first tried to read It, I just couldn't, like, once it got that past that first chapter and the real story started to take hold, I would just, you know, it couldn't hold my attention long enough. So I didn't come back to It and read it in its entirety until I was like 18 or 19. Mm-hmm. But those are tough ones to really, but once you're in it, man, it has you. I know a few fewer stories that can really grab hold and even carry you through the parts that maybe should have been edited out for length.
Well, actually, I like the director's cut where they put the stuff back in.
I know that's a controversial take too, because a lot of people are like, oh, actually the original was better. I don't think so. I do feel that, the ending does have like a kind of a multiple ending thing going on, sort of like the end of the Lord of the Rings a little bit. But it's an epic. I mean, that's part of it. You have to resolve.
Well, and I think too, he just had to, because The Stand is the one where he's like, I have so many characters on the table mm-hmm. that I can't deal with their storylines anymore. So I'm going to blow them up with the shoebox.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, the guy.
The mom. That's, the mom.
Which, you know,
the shoebox mom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think almost at the end, it felt like he kind of had the same thing where it's like, I got to land the plane. You know, and I got to deal with New Vegas, you know, and the whole routine. And it's just like, I got to land the plane.
When your monster has gotten out of hand almost, but it's, I find that fascinating to watch those resolutions kind of take place. And I will say, to his credit, I feel like he does that better than a lot of authors of, like, say, sprawling epic fantasy tend to do. Robert Jordan, you know, like, where you get this massive, massive world and you haven't killed anyone.
Yeah.
In fact, you need to kill some folks, people. I mean, start pruning that bush down, because it is turned into a gnarled monster.
Exactly. And I think that's with, you know, it's like, I have to end this, you know, I have a deadline, and it's hand to God, atomic bomb, boom, we've taken care of New Vegas. Okay, there. But Night Surf is just a nice little subset. And one thing I did do when I introduced the kids to Yates is I took the two chapters out of the stand where he deals with Yates. And I actually, you know, broke them down and I talked to the kids. It's like, what is the Falcon? Yeah. What has broken free and is no longer listening? What is moving in a widening gyre? And finally, a little girl pops up. She puts her hand up. She goes, the virus? And I'm like, get over here and let me kiss you on the head, baby.
Awesome. It's really cool to use a poem or a passage like that to really, because that takes an extra layer of interpretation a lot of times.
And, you know, why are we still quoting Yeats type of thing. So that was definitely fun. But yeah, I mean, I think we've definitely hit the high points.
Because, like, sometimes they come back. I think that's like the remaining one. And that one is almost plays like it's your standard kind of making a deal with the devil kind of situation to deal with ghosts, which I think is interesting in its own right. I think that we could stand to use a newer adaptation. It was made in 1991 as a TV movie, I believe. And I feel like it has such a good trope of, like, yeah, you can have this favor, but I'm probably going to be back. And the fact that he takes the form of his dead brother, the brother that was murdered by these guys that are, yeah.
Well, this book in general, except for Lawnmower Man and maybe Trucks.
Yeah, yeah.
Could be, you know, one of the cable channels could pick this up.
Yes.
And do it correctly.
I completely agree to do a true anthology of it, because even the Nightmares and Dreamscapes anthology, it was just a short series, but it actually incorporated stories from this, and it didn't stick to the Nightmares and Dreamscapes collection.
Right.
Just use the title. So I really would absolutely welcome if someone could do anthology series on all the collections. Let's do Skeleton Crew.
Yes.
Let's do Night Shift. Let's do Everything's Eventual.
And do, you know, do it like they do it now, you know, five episodes is a season, and stick to the source material. Don't freestyle it.
Yeah.
And the cable, they could do those gory.
Oh, sure. They could do a Black Mirror treatment even on Netflix. Just do, five or six episodes for a season, and then we can just wait. I feel like anthology storytelling, this type of short storytelling, is so vital and so important and so amazing when it's done well, that you can be the perfect economist of language.
Yes.
And show what it is truly capable of. That's why short stories really...
I love short stories. I love anthologies. And I just haven't been writing them like I should be.
I haven't either. When I got my start writing short stories, like most authors, and then you get off into the realm of trying to write a novel and get that out into the world and get the agent. And then one novel begets another. And all of a sudden you find, oh my God, I have not written a short story in 5 years. And it breaks my heart. I watch you and so many of our mutual author friends putting out these amazing anthologies and short stories. I love when one of our friends, and you have been as well, gets a story in Shotgun Honey. I am pulling that thing up. I love that. I would love to write something for that.
That was the last one I had in Shotgun Honey was one of my favorites, because
so good.
It is actually how I got to know a bunch of the writers, the crime writers, was through the Bruce Springsteen anthology crime. And I missed that one.
Yeah.
But I told, when I did it to Shotgun Honey, I said, here's the story I would have written.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a Bruce Springsteen song. It's Darlington County.
So good. Yeah.
And that, you know, that one of, oh shit, what happened in
I wanted so much more. After I finished reading that, by the way, I was ready for that.
Why was Wayne handcuffed to the bumper of that state trooper's Ford?
y'all got to read Shotgun Honey. And what's the title of that one again?
Gosh, now I can't remember.
Yeah, guys, search Terry Lynn Coop, Shotgun Honey. Go and
I've got two in there. And then the other one's called Sharp Focus, which has just a little touch of supernatural because it too is the deal with the devil.
Yes, yes.
The musician makes the deal with the devil.
And the word limit, those are pretty short, yeah.
800 words.
Oh, so it's flash fiction.
Total flash fiction.
Which again is even a bigger superpower because even my shortest short story is about 1200.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely an art form. And I need to get some more ideas. Because I love Shotgun Honey.
I got a few ideas in my head when Ken and I did our cross country trip here, just driving through some of that weird part of the, you know, as I call it, the desert weird. It really gave me some great.
Oh, I can't wait for my epic road trip.
I can't wait either.
It's called Cowboy Jamboree, and they're actually doing a Larry McMurtry issue.
Oh, okay.
And Archer City is one of my stops.
Yes.
Archer City pretty much has one industry, and it's being Larry McMurtry's hometown.
The worst things to be, yeah?
They restored the theater from Last Picture Show, burned, and they restored it.
Oh, wow.
They almost demolished it, and everybody, no, no, no. And there was this, you know, like worldwide fundraising event, and they restored the theater from Last Picture Show, and it's an art house now. Typically not a literary fiction fan.
Right.
Except for Larry McMurtry.
Well, he creates a feeling of accessibility.
Texasville. Oh my God. You know, and here I am reading, you know, this much a literary fiction that ends with an egg fight in the, you know, in the main street of this, you know, Thalia, Texas type of thing.
Yeah.
And then there's Dwayne, you know, and then he keeps following it up. And these are follow-ups to Last Picture Show.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where Dwayne gets depressed.
Yeah.
And he decides, I'm just not going to drive anymore. I'm going to walk everywhere. And he lays out the line, his wife, who is this interesting person, gets killed in a car accident. And he describes her by saying she was hard to love and easy to miss.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, I know. Through the heart.
That's a great line.
It's just like, bam, right through right through the heart. So definitely I'm hoping I can get some writing done on epic road trip.
I hope you can too. I feel like that there is something incredibly liberating for the mind and the spirit, just getting out there on the road and seeing the openness and the vastness of everything.
Mm-hmm. I adore Florida. I love living here, but I need to be someplace else. I need to get away from the traffic. I need to be someplace else.
Yeah. And that really is what it comes down to, is getting also that perspective on how other people live elsewhere.
I need to be back to the place where you drive an hour to go to a thrift shop just because.
That's exactly right. And that, you know, I felt that when we were driving across Kansas, you were on my mind a lot as I was making that drive. I'm like, man, Terry lived out here, man. That had to be something.
it had its moments. It definitely had its moments. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I love it here too. And you're welcome here anytime.
Yeah, I know the crew is trying to get me. I've not set foot in your borders yet. And that's the funny thing. I look at my map that I've been coloring in with all the states I visited, and there's just lonely Florida now. I've covered a good bit while I've not gotten through most of the deep South either. So Alabama, Mississippi.
We'll take care of Louisiana. Uh-huh.
Oh yeah, girl. We're going to do that.
But yeah, again, I think we definitely took care of the anthology.
We took care of Night Shift, and I think in beautiful form. And I thank you so much for coming on. You were a very busy person.
I know. I love it. I love it. I talk books anytime.
That makes me so happy. And I know a lot of our listeners that are tuning into this and want to have the Stephen King book club experience. That's what I wanted to give people with this season of this show. And next season, it's going to be something completely different. So
I can't wait.
And I want to have your legal mind on here for some things. I want to have your engineering mind on here for some things. So I just...
Anytime.
You know, and your historical knowledge. So yes, I am so happy, Terry. And now... please like tell people, go out and find your books. Tell them where to find them and where they can find you if you want people to find you.
Well, I mean, always Amazon,
yes.
You know, yes. And Jewel and Ethan, they're the first two books. It's crime with some romance, you know, although they, because it's me, the romantic suspense is incredibly awkward.
I know that you and me both are in that club.
So. Yes. And the first two books there. And then of course, all the anthologies, most of which support charity. So Terry Lynn Coop on Amazon, you can find me there. And I'm cooking up something else right now that's totally different. And we'll see where that goes, if it goes anywhere.
Oh, well, I'm intrigued. I'm very intrigued. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for stopping in. And coming up soon will be episodes on Pet Cemetery. We got Hearts in Atlantis. We have Everything's Eventual, 1408, The Man in the Black Suit, all those great things. Even more in store. If you like this episode, please reach out to me at ddarknesstime on Twitter or Gmail. You can also find me on Instagram under that same handle. And you can also hop over onto iTunes and give the show a rating and a review. It really helps lift it up and make it more accessible to or visible to people looking for fun and interesting shows to listen to, of which I hope you will consider this one of them. So that's it for now, guys. And we are signing off and we'll see you again soon. Ding Dong Darkness Time has been brought to you and produced by yours truly, Allison Dixon. It was made possible by an array of amazing co-hosts, friends, family, but especially you, the listeners. Big shouts also go out to the brilliant Nathaniel Dixon for the show art and future legend Spencer Morlock for all the music. I'll be back again soon with another episode. In the meantime, be good, you little ding dongs.